This is a CBC podcast. Got Twitter? Be sure to follow CBC Radio. Get updates on what's on and converse with a real CBC producer, not just a tweeting robot. Follow us at twitter.com/CBC Radio.
Isn't it about time you rescued someone from a burning building?
Isn't it about time you saved somebody's life?
Isn't it about time you helped someone out of a jam?
Isn't it about time you did something that really matters?
When fire departments like this one in Phoenix fish for new recruits, they talk up the excitement of saving lives and making a difference. It's the same thing that attracts most paramedics, MDs, and nurses to the work we do. But what happens when the adrenaline rush is gone and excitement is replaced with despair? I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. Welcome to White Coat Black Art on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. This week, we look at burnout on my side of the gurney. If I named every 40-something doctor or nurse I know who says they feel exhausted, stressed, and frustrated, I could fill the whole show. Of course, people in every walk of life get burned out. But when it's someone whose job it is to care for you, well then, it's not just their problem, it could be yours. Today I speak with a family doc whose passion for his practice has given way to apathy. I meet a young ICU nurse who is already planning a career change. And I have a disturbing conversation with an expert in compassion fatigue who says the toll of burnout is not only on health professionals, but on their patients too. This week, experts from Canada and around the world are gathering in London to help MDs deal with their own health problems, including burnout. Makes you wonder. Medicine has a lot going for it. Good income, social status, incredible job satisfaction, and something else. One of the highest rates of burnout among professionals. According to recent studies, as many as half of Canada's doctors, an even higher proportion of nurses. When we're in training, we're rewarded with marks and praise from mentors. If you work hard, you do well. If you or one of the team loses a patient, you don't usually flunk. But as soon as you enter practice, no more compliments from mentors, no more marks, good or bad. Your reward is income, except that in our system, good docs and bad get the same fees. That leaves the smiles and gratitude of patients. But what do they really know about how good I am? Then, stuff starts to happen. You make a mistake or two. It's inevitable. Maybe you lose a patient. Or someone complains to the college. It happens to most of us. Suddenly, medicine doesn't seem quite so rewarding. All the money and gratitude in the world can't make up for the stress and that empty feeling inside. John Aquino doesn't want to be misunderstood either. In fact, he's typical of burned-out doctors, shouldering the burden of a mix of professional and personal issues. After training to be a family doc in Toronto, he joined a busy practice in North Carolina. There, Aquino recognized the beginnings of burnout, finding it difficult to always meet the emotional needs of his patients.
So how did it show up in your day-to-day practice? For me, I found I could be distracted.
Mm-hmm. I think I can become irritable at times if I've tried to be, you know, nice and accommodating and friendly, and treat the problem that is apparent today. But then at the last second, if they wanted me to deal with two other issues that really are going to take a lot of time, if I say, well, I'm just not going to have time to deal with that today, if they sort of get annoyed visibly, then I feel annoyed too. So I think then there's a little of friction there, and that I don't feel good about that at all.
So you bristled.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm terrified of bristling because I'm afraid somebody's going to complain. you know, and that they'll complain to the college that I'm, you know, that I snap back at them.
Sure. So how, but how do we deal with that? I can't necessarily deal with all those problems in a day. I don't. And if I had a pre-existing relationship with everybody, it would be easier. But when you don't, it's tougher.
Is this the kind of thing you'd ever go to a doctor about?
I don't think so. No, I can pretty well say no.
Why not?
Whenever I have a medical problem myself, I think maybe I should go to a doctor. And I think, what would I say to myself if I was there? And I'd say, I would say this, this, this. And then I say, I don't need to go to my doctor.
And what would you say to yourself?
I would be supportive to myself and just say we all have good days and bad days. We all try our best, but we can only do so much. And don't be so hard on yourself. That's what I would say to myself in a nutshell. I'd probably spend 10 minutes saying it.
People in all walks of life suffer from burnout. Why should people care if people like us are burned out?
If people really want to get good health care, they don't want a burnt out provider.
Why not?
A lot of medicine is about the relationship. It's about the support you can get from your doctor. It's about the time you can get explaining things. If you have a cynical burnt out provider, you're gonna get bare bones. You're gonna get a prescription, but you're not gonna get anything else.
Do you think you're alone?
Oh, not at all. I think I would think the majority of doctors, to a degree, are burnt out in a way. I think it shows up just in more cynicism. I think that's a sign of burnout. I would say that that most doctors are walking on the edge.
What does it mean to be walking on the edge?
Well, you're doing the job. You're doing the best you can. But after a while, the term "best I can" is like saying not very good, not very well. We're not doing a great job, but we're doing the best we can under the circumstances.
Do you think that doctors in Canada these days are more likely to burn out than, say, doctors in the United States?
I think people can burn out either side of the border. I think for different reasons. In the U.S., you're supported, but you have to work very hard, and it's a large obligation to do a very comprehensive job for a fairly large number of people, and that can burn you out. In Canada, we work on volume. Doctors are paid piecemeal, and even to support a practice, they have to see a lot of people. And so it's tough to do that and to make your patients happy, and that creates a stress. If people don't sense they're being well cared for, even if medically their needs are being met, then that creates dissatisfaction, because that's why we went into medicine, to help people. Even if you're helping them, but they sense that you could be doing better, that creates a lot of dissatisfaction on both sides.
Notice that John Aquino said, you're going to get a cynical, bare-bones provider. But he said nothing about quitting. Even the most burned-out MD is unlikely to do that. How else would they earn a living, most wonder? And many of my colleagues have so much time invested in medicine, they wouldn't know what to do instead. So far, we've been talking about frustrated MDs. Studies show even more nurses, especially young ones, are disgruntled enough to pack it in. For some, the path to burnout begins the moment they realize the discrepancy between what they were trained to do in nursing school and the reality of life on the job. Deborah Lowe, an ICU nurse in Vancouver, is one of them.
I went to school at University of Victoria, and it's a fairly liberal university. There was a lot of talk of, you know, women's liberation and nursing coming forward and being a more responsible profession and nurses having more power. And when I got out, I was very surprised at how things were quite different than how I'd been taught. Nurses really still seem to be in a secondary role to doctors. And I was surprised by the lack of respect that I felt as a nurse. And this is stuff I was expected to do as a nurse that I didn't get taught in nursing school.
Give me some examples.
Well, the first place I worked in Victoria, the cleaning staff weren't allowed to clean up bodily fluids. So guess who did that? That was us. Cleaning bedpans, commodes, answering the phone. I answer the phone a lot. I feel like a glorified secretary sometimes. That sort of thing. Stocking carts, cleaning equipment because there's none around, cleaning the floor, sort of anything that there's anything. Everything is a nurse's job. If no one's doing it, it has to get done. So generally, it's a nurse that does it. I feel frustrated a lot by what I feel is I have a lot of responsibility where I work, but I don't have a lot of autonomy. I'll give you an example. I'm on the Code Blue team, so when someone's heart stops in the hospital, we run with our crash cart and go revive them. I was on the Code Blue team. I ran to the Code. I was with new doctors, so I was sort of running, telling them how to run the Code. So we revive the patient, we bring him back. He's not doing well. We ended up having to sort of give up on him. So I turned the ventilator off. I was with the family, you know, grieving with them. The Code pager goes off again. I go to another Code, you know, that sort of plays itself out. I come back to the unit and the first patient has died. And even though I was the person that was at the Code, you know, that turned off the ventilator, I'm not allowed to pronounce the patient dead. So I have to wait for 2 hours for a resident to come who's never met the patient to say, yes, this patient's dead. It's kind of a slap in the face, I think.
Still, it took more than a figurative slap in the face to get Nurse Deborah Lowe to consider moving on.
I began to feel really burnt out about 4 months ago. I had one particular incident with a patient where I really didn't agree with the direction we were going, and this patient was really sick. As a nurse, I couldn't, and I jumped up and down, but I couldn't influence the direction of care.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what it was about?
It was a patient that was really, really, really sick and not going to make it, and we just pulled out all the stops for this person, and I just didn't feel comfortable with the direction it was going, because I thought that I knew that it would inevitably end in death for this woman, whether it be, you know, 3 days from now or today. I'm not a doctor, and it's not my call. But I think after that point, I started to really think about what can I do next.
What was it about that situation? Was it that you couldn't bear the thought of being by the family while all of this care was being delivered, and that they needed to be prepared for what you thought was inevitable?
I think it was in the ICU. A lot of our interventions they're painful, and a lot of the stuff we do it's very invasive, and I just didn't see the point in carrying on. And I wanted this person to be able to have a little bit of dignity in their passing. So I didn't feel like I could do that because I had to follow certain orders. So that was a real turning point for me, I think, powerless like that.
What was it like going into work the next time after that? And the day after that and the day after that?
I think I'd made my mind up after that I was going to leave, and I guess I feel even now when I go to work I feel a little more detached from it because I know I'm going to have to try something to do something new soon, so I feel a little more detached from work. I am less involved. I feel less involved sometimes when I'm there.
What does that
mean?
In
my, I'm somebody that really likes to keep current with my practice. I go to a lot of conferences. I do a lot of reading, and I have a notebook that I update constantly. I've been doing less of that.
Do you think it's ever, aside from that sense of commitment, do you think it's affected your day-to-day work in other ways?
I'm probably, with my colleagues, I'm probably a little less sunny at work, I would say. I have less enthusiasm for the work. I complain a lot more than I used to, which I don't like in myself. And I look at things in a negative light when that's not necessarily the way they are. I feel like I don't give people the benefit of a doubt as often as I used to. And I have a harder time seeing things from other people's point of view. So I think it's sort of, I've cast a bit of a pall over my practice, which is my burnout, which isn't necessarily the way things are.
Are you exceptional when it comes to burnout, or are you typical?
I think I'm pretty typical, Brian, unfortunately. Where I work, there's a lot of talk of what we're going to do next after we're done nurses.
You and your
but
colleagues?
Done being nursing, yeah. A lot of people are leaving. A lot of people my age have been practicing for about 4 or 5 years. There's a lot of talk of what we're going to do when we win the lottery. What could we do next? What other career could we have that would be less frustrating, more satisfying, more pay, that sort of thing? And maybe I'm just more attuned to it now than I have been in the past, but a lot of my colleagues are leaving.
We're not leaving just yet. You're listening to White Coat Black Art on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. So far, we've heard from two people who care a great deal about their patients, to the point at which they felt they have nothing left to give. That's called compassion fatigue, a sort of occupational hazard. Françoise Mathieu is a counselor in Kingston who specializes in getting inside the heads of people like me.
Healthcare professionals like me, like us, we like to think of ourselves as a special case. You know, we go home and say, you don't know what it's like. And you kind of get the feeling that others don't understand we're different. So are we different?
I think it is different for us, and for two reasons. One of them is that often due to confidentiality restrictions, we actually can't tell people what we did. Or sometimes, in spite of confidentiality, we do tell them and they don't get it. We can come home and tell, you know, if our, I don't know if your husband's an architect or, you know, a scientist like mine is, he may not understand why I'm so drained and don't feel like talking, or he may be horrified by the stories I do come home and share with him.
So are there studies to show that we're actually more burdened?
Very much so. Every study has shown the same. Basically, 50% of helping professionals are profoundly affected, I would even say damaged, by the work that they do, to the degree where they actually have symptoms of secondary traumatic stress, not unlike post-traumatic stress, which affects, for example, the soldier who goes to Afghanistan, right? We're kind of familiar with that concept. We actually develop a similar syndrome, which is a secondary traumatic stress. Now, in trauma care workers, so for example, nurses who work in hospice, palliative care doctors, up to 80% of them actually have elements of severe secondary traumatic stress and continue staying and working in this field, but they're very compromised.
Well, okay, let me give you an example. Recently, and we've got this whole confidentiality issue, so I say this very delicately. I saw an elderly patient with advanced Alzheimer's disease who had taken a turn for the worst, and I had this very uncomfortable conversation with the adult children about what to do if their loved one's heart stops. And I found myself getting very irritated with them, where obviously it's their decision, but what I wanted to be able to do was make them see my point of view. And the more I tried to make them see my point of view, the more difficult the conversation between us became, and eventually I just gave up. And we kind of agreed to hope that it never came to that point. I'll make a confession. I have an elderly mother with advanced Alzheimer's disease, and I was relating my own experience to theirs. So diagnose me.
I think that's a perfect example. That's actually called countertransference, right? And countertransference is when your stuff is being activated by the client's or the patient's issue. Countertransference and vicarious trauma, for example, are very, very similar, and they walk hand in hand, because what is happening, you know, that idea of somehow the impartial physician that feels nothing and you know, doesn't get affected by these things, that does exist. There are some trades that I would somehow
but
suspect.
I couldn't. They were driving right. me. It was driving me crazy.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, we were both on the same side of,
yes,
you know, we have the same issues, but somehow it was their stubbornness to even,
yes,
consider that there might be another way of dealing with this.
So I think what's hard about that is these two things. When I was a crisis worker and I had seven people waiting in my waiting room and someone in my office who I knew was going to need 3 hours of care, I had to, first of all, navigate the reality of what I can provide physically, what my agency can provide compared to their needs. So that's one reason I can become impatient or irritable. The second reason you can become irritable or impatient with patients is that you have heard this story a million times before. The longer you're in this field, the longer, the more predictable the client and patient issues become. That is good on the one hand. It makes you extremely good, probably strong. Diagnostically, you are competent and confident. Sometimes, though, that can end up making us silence the clients or patients. It makes us jump ahead and not ask certain questions. You know, we forget that this is the first time they've had to deal with this life, end-of-life decision. Maybe it's the 50th time you've done it in 2 days. So we jump ahead, and that is actually a hallmark of compassion fatigue, is that we become very desensitized to some of our patients' needs. And this is the kind of thing that we don't necessarily admit or feel proud about, right? There's a lot of shame associated with compassion fatigue, which is partly why I've made it sort of my, I guess you'd call it a mission, to debunk this and validate helpers to say, in my opinion, it happens to almost everyone in this field to some degree. And there are certain things you will do that you will not be proud of.
Patients are listening to this right now. What would they notice in a healthcare worker who's suffering from compassion fatigue?
Patients will experience this in many ways. They will have the, everyone has a nurse ratchet that they've thought about, you know, the terrifying ward nurse that scares everyone and you're afraid to ask her anything. They will have the distant, and again, Tilda Shaloff describes the residents so perfectly in her book about they're very vague, they're very distant. They will avoid actually having contact with the family. They will sometimes do as little as possible and send someone else because they just can't. Either they don't want to deal with emotions or they can't. My brother-in-law is a cardiologist, and he's talked about the challenges of that work when you have to give bad news and the impact that it has. So patients will experience it in the diminished quality of care or certainly diminished quality of bedside manners.
You said diminished quality of care. What is – can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. There's an increased potential for medical errors.
I'm struck by you being so willing and so ready to say that compassion fatigue can cause medical errors and can compromise safety, because most experts don't say that. They say the opposite. They say that your competence is the last thing to change.
Well, first of all, I think that there's a whole bunch of stuff. Okay, let me back up. So what I will say is that I am a mental health practitioner. I have a private practice in Kingston. And in my practice, I see doctors, nurses, social workers, you know, every professional you can think of, medical students, come and talk to me, and they tell me the truth.
And what do they tell you?
They tell me that there are times where they make medical errors, and they don't tell anyone, right? Because they can't. And they tell me that they work in hospitals where there are times where the care is compromised, and they cannot tell anyone. So what worries me about that is that there is a whole unspoken world. People have access to medication. Physicians and nurses have access to narcotics that they might use to self-medicate. No one is going to talk about that. No one's going to talk about the fact that you needed to drink a 40 of vodka the night before you had to go to work. No one talks about that. So there is an incredible silence around this topic.
What kinds of errors do healthcare professionals tell you about in the safety and security of your office?
So I speak more to people who do psychiatric care rather than physical health care, so I can speak more to that. They will confess to things like not carrying out a suicide assessment because they can't cope with the answer. Not asking about homicide or lethality because they can't cope with the answer that the patient may. What do you do if it's Friday afternoon and it's 5 minutes before the end of your shift and the patient says, actually, I am actually thinking of harming someone else or myself? This is not the kind of stuff that anyone will admit to, obviously. I understand why.
Because?
Well, first of all, there's a risk of malpractice and there's a lack of peer support that feels safe. There isn't, in many places, a safe place for you to go and to say, this client wanting to tell me about something and I silenced her. There's something called actually the silencing response that Dr. Baranowski, who's a psychologist in Toronto, has studied. And the silencing response is something where she basically can monitor or measure how the different ways in which we are silencing our patients because we can't handle their answer because we are too depleted to deal with it.
So you're saying that this is a major safety risk?
I think this is actually a huge issue that needs to be part of occupational health and safety, the way that we have had back injuries, slip and fall, and sharps. I think that this needs to be done in a proper way. The risk is that you identify physicians and nurses as having compassion fatigue, and then we isolate them and shame them into feeling that they're doing something wrong. And that's not the take-home message at all. The take-home message is that I think that we all suffer from this to some degree. We just don't necessarily tell anyone else how depleted we can be.
So, we need to recognize how depleted we are emotionally without shame or fear of retribution, and before we harm our patients. We ourselves need professionals to turn to when we're in the grip of burnout. The Center for Physician Health and Well-Being in Ottawa has been helping MDs since 2003. There are places for other health professionals, too. But ultimately, when it comes to burnout, the old adage is still true. Health professional, heal thyself. We love hearing from you. Email us at whitecoat@cbc.ca. If you want to hear the program again, you can download it as a podcast from our website, cbc.ca/whitecoat, where you can also contribute to our blog. This edition of White Coat Black Art was produced by Lara Hindle and senior producer Quade Herman. That's medicine from my side of the gurney. I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.